May 12th, 2000. The South Pole, Antarctica. While working at the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station, 32-year-old Australian astrophysicist Rodney Marks becomes seriously ill before he dies. Rodney's death is initially assumed to be natural causes, but when his body is transported to New Zealand months later, an autopsy reveals that he died from acute methanol poisoning. The New Zealand police attempt to launch an investigation, but run into jurisdictional issues, and Rodney's American-based employers prove to be uncooperative. A coroner's inquest fails to turn up any conclusive evidence to support Rodney's death being a homicide, suicide, or accidental, so there's still no answers about how he was poisoned. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and for the very first time, we're going to be covering an unsolved mystery which took place in Antarctica. The unexplained 2000 death of Rodney Marks. This case was originally suggested to me about 2 years ago by a listener named Penrod, and I've been meaning to tackle it for a while, as the unusual setting alone really makes this story stand out. Rodney Marks was an astrophysicist from Australia who was assigned to a year-long stint working at a scientific research station in the South Pole, but after falling ill one day, Rodney's condition gradually worsened until he died around 24 hours later. The freezing weather conditions made it impossible to fly Rodney's body back to the mainland for nearly 6 months, and it was only then that an autopsy revealed that his cause of death was methanol poisoning. But by this point, the 49 other people who worked at the research station alongside Rodney had all returned home and gone their separate ways. Since the New Zealand police had handled the autopsy, they wanted to conduct a full-scale investigation into Rodney's death, but we're talking about an Australian citizen who died in Antarctica at a station controlled by an independent agency of the United States government. Since this sort of situation was pretty much unprecedented, you can only imagine the massive red tape and jurisdictional issues. The media would refer to this story as the first South Pole murder, but without a thorough investigation, it was impossible to determine if Rodney's death was actually a murder, or if it could have been a suicide, or a tragic accident, or a prank gone horribly wrong. Rodney was known for being a heavy drinker, which provides the most logical explanation for how he could have ingested the methanol. But whether it was because someone attempted to intentionally poison him is still unclear. It's a pretty baffling mystery which has a number of potential theories that we're going to explore, and despite the Antarctica setting, I solemnly swear that I will not fall into the trap of making a bunch of bad Trail Went Cold puns. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the unexplained death of Rodney Marks. Our story begins in Antarctica in 2000, and our central figure is 32-year-old Rodney David Marks. Rodney was originally born in Geelong, Australia, and while he would struggle with a mild case of Tourette syndrome, he proved to be a very bright child who started doing crossword puzzles using a thesaurus at age 7. Rodney excelled in school, first obtaining a bachelor's degree in astronomy at the University of Melbourne, before earning a doctorate in physics at the University of New South Wales. He sought a career in astrophysics, and was particularly fascinated by the South Pole, which he wrote his thesis on. Rodney considered it to be a great location for astrophysical observation, so he traveled there on a 2-week radio astronomy research stint in 1994. 3 years later, Rodney decided to return to the South Pole for what would be a full 1-year-long research stint, as he was assigned by the University of Chicago's Center for Astrophysical Research in Antarctica, aka CARA, to work on their South Pole Infrared Explorer project. The project took place at the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station, a scientific research center located at the southernmost point of the world and named after Roald Amundsen and Robert F. Scott, the first two explorers to ever reach the South Pole. The station is run by the National Science Foundation, aka the NSF, an independent agency funded by the United States government. The NSF are responsible for all American scientific activity in Antarctica, and back then, they often subcontracted a lot of this work to the Polar Services Division of the Raytheon Technologies Corporation. Rodney was stationed there from November of 1997 until November of 1998, and enjoyed the experience so much that he decided to sign up for another year-long stint on CARA's Antarctic Submillimeter Telescope and Research Observatory project. It would last from November of 1999 until November of 2000, and consist of such tasks as measuring ozone in the atmosphere and capturing subatomic particles and neutrinos from space. Rodney would work as the project's winter over scientist, and one of his main responsibilities was coordinating experiments and collecting data by operating the submillimeter telescope to observe radiation from gas clouds around star-forming regions in space. The Amundsen Scott Station was situated at a location which had 6 consecutive summer months of non-stop daylight, followed by 6 consecutive winter months of non-stop darkness. A crew of 250 people would work at the station during the summer season before returning home, while a crew of 50 scientists, technicians, construction crew, and other personnel remained there during the winter season. Rodney was one of the 50 who volunteered to stay all year round, and shortly after he arrived, he became involved with a 33-year-old maintenance specialist named Sonia Walter. The couple almost immediately hit it off, and even put together a heavy metal band there called Fanny Pack and the Big Nancy Boys. While Sonia was only supposed to work at the station during the summer months, she volunteered to extend her stay there so she could remain with Rodney during his entire year-long stint. They also decided to get engaged and planned to marry each other once they returned to the mainland. Anyway, a lot of Rodney's work took place inside the station's remote observatory, which required him to make a daily 1 kilometer commute between the observatory and the main base in freezing temperatures. On May the 11th, while walking towards the base, Rodney started feeling ill, and over the next 24 hours, his condition would keep worsening. While eating dinner in the galley with Sonia that night, Rodney told her that he wasn't feeling well and was having trouble seeing clearly, so he went to bed early. At 5:30 a.m. on the morning of May 12th, Rodney woke up with a burning sensation in the pit of his stomach and started vomiting blood. Over the course of the day, he would make 3 visits to the base's medical facility and was checked out by the physician, Dr. Robert Thompson. Rodney had a reputation around the base for being a bit of a binge drinker and would sometimes drink to mask the symptoms of his Tourette syndrome, so Dr. Thompson initially wondered if Rodney was suffering from the effects of alcohol withdrawal or perhaps even an anxiety attack. Prior to his deployment to the South Pole, Rodney had been required to complete a number of rigorous medical and psychological exams, and he easily passed without any noticeable issues. By the time Rodney made his second visit to Dr. Thompson, he said he had trouble moving due to the pains in his joints and muscles, and he had to wear sunglasses to protect his eyes so he was injected with a sedative. Since Thompson could not figure out what was wrong with Rodney, he hoped to seek outside medical advice by using a satellite phone, but it was standard practice to be without a signal for a large portion of the day. The sedative only calmed down Rodney for a short time, and it wasn't long before he started hyperventilating and returned to the medical facility with Sonia at his side. This time, Dr. Thompson injected Rodney with a powerful antipsychotic called Haldol, but Rodney soon started losing consciousness and going into cardiac arrest before his heart stopped. The trauma team was summoned to assist him, but when all attempts to resuscitate Rodney failed, he was officially pronounced dead at 6:45 p.m. Rodney's death took everyone at the base by complete shock, and it soon became apparent that it would be impossible to transport his body back to the mainland for months. During the South Pole's winter season, the bad weather is incredibly severe, and temperatures can dip below minus 80 degrees Celsius. While it was possible for planes to fly over the area and airdrop supplies if necessary, landing was out of the question, since the temperatures could cause a plane's hydraulic fluids to freeze within minutes of touching down. So Rodney's co-workers decided to build a wooden casket and buried him in a temporary grave outside the base, as the cold would help preserve his body until it could be picked up. In the meantime, Dr. Thompson told the other personnel at the base that Rodney's death was the result of unknown but natural causes, possibly due to a heart attack or aneurysm, and the National Science Foundation would issue a formal statement which pretty much stated the exact same thing. The official report read, quote, "There is no evidence to point to homicide, accidental poisoning, environmental toxicity, or infection," end quote. Well, by the end of October, the summer season was finally beginning, so it was now safe enough for a plane to land at the station and pick up Rodney's body. It would be flown to Christchurch, New Zealand, the official base for American activities in Antarctica, and both the United States and Australia would consent to a coroner's inquest being held there. However, shortly after an autopsy was performed, a shocking announcement was made. Rodney's exact cause of death was acute methanol poisoning. Only a small amount of methanol can prove fatal, and around 150 milliliters was found in Rodney's bloodstream, and it seemed likely that he had somehow consumed or ingested it. The base had a large supply of methanol, and Rodney used it to clean the telescopes, but as far as anyone knew, he had not done so since January, and all the bottles of methanol were clearly marked and kept inside a locked cabinet. Curiously, a pair of needle marks were found on Rodney's right arm, even though he was right-handed. While trace amounts of alcohol were found in Rodney's system, there was no sign of illegal drugs. In his official report, Dr. Thompson would claim that while he was treating Rodney, he drew blood from his right arm and noticed that these needle marks were already there. Rodney apparently told him that he had made previous attempts at intravenous drug use, including at a party he attended in Christchurch shortly before arriving at the South Pole, but he maintained that most of these incidents occurred in the quote-unquote distant past. Thompson also said that when he asked Rodney about the last time he drank alcohol, Rodney said he hadn't done so in nearly 2 days. Anyway, following the autopsy, Rodney's body was returned to Australia so his family could finally give him a proper burial, but they began to suspect that Rodney might have been the victim of foul play. The investigation would be handled by the New Zealand police and assigned to Detective Senior Sergeant Grant Warmald. However, the problem was that this was an unprecedented situation, and there was a lot of confusion about who had official jurisdiction. In 1961, the Antarctic Treaty System was entered into force after it was signed and ratified by 53 countries who all had an interest in setting up scientific research stations on the continent. Each of these countries could make territorial claims if they desired, and the Amundsen-Scott South Pole Station happened to be located within the Ross Dependency region, which was officially claimed by New Zealand when the treaty was signed. However, the United States government does not recognize New Zealand's claim to territorial sovereignty or the application of New Zealand law to American citizens who would have been operating in Antarctica. In their eyes, Workers accused of a serious crime at a research station were subject to the laws and jurisdiction of their home country, so all questioning and investigations involving American citizens attached to the case would be performed by the American authorities. And even though Rodney Marks was an Australian citizen, the majority of the personnel occupying the Amundsen Scott Station at the time of Rodney's death were American. The investigation was also hampered by the fact that Rodney's body had to remain at the station for 6 months before an autopsy could be performed, and by that point, the 49 other workers from the base had already gone their separate ways and returned to their respective homes. Since it was initially announced that Rodney's death was the result of natural causes, his office and sleeping quarters were not preserved for an investigation, and they continued to be used, and while some of his personal items were collected and returned to his family, other items were just thrown away. Over the course of the next 6 years, the investigation into Rodney's death would be conducted in secrecy until a coronial inquest was held in New Zealand in 2006. After a series of hearings, the inquest was indefinitely adjourned, and the case started receiving attention in the media again. In September of 2008, a written report from the inquest was released publicly for the first time, and it confirmed that Rodney had died as a result of acute methanol poisoning. However, the coroner cannot find any evidence to conclusively determine if Rodney's death was a homicide, suicide, or an accident. While the report made note of the lack of cooperation from both the National Science Foundation and their contractor, Raytheon Technologies Corporation, and Detective Senior Sergeant Wormald showed no hesitation about publicly expressing his frustration with them. According to Wormald, the U.S. Department of Justice was unable to perform official interviews with any of the workers from the Amundsen Scott Station because the coronial inquest was considered an informal inquiry, so the NSF and Raytheon had jurisdiction. The NSF told the New Zealand police that they had already performed their own internal investigation and concluded that Rodney's death was the result of natural causes, but when Wormald asked for an official report of this investigation, he was informed that no such report existed. The NSF also failed to provide a list of the 49 other employees who had been assigned to the base at the time of Rodney's death, and the New Zealand police actually had to look up their names on the internet. The NSF did provide consent for the police to mail out questionnaires to these employees on the condition that they could screen the questions beforehand, and they also demanded that the employees be made aware that the questionnaires were strictly voluntary. After they were sent out, the police only received a response from 13 of the 49 employees. Wormald was most frustrated by his inability to track down the base physician, Dr. Robert Thompson. It turned out that Thompson possessed a machine called an Etch-A-Chem, a device which can measure a patient's blood chemistry, but it was never used on Rodney, both before or after his death. Thompson's story was that the Etch-A-Chem's lithium battery had died, which meant that the machine had to be recalibrated every time it was turned on, a process which took between 8 to 10 hours. Thompson had never made any attempt to fix it, but if the Etch-A-Chem had been functional and used on Rodney when he first became ill, it might have detected the methanol poisoning and potentially saved his life. Unfortunately, since Dr. Thompson could not be found, he was never formally questioned by the New Zealand police or provided any testimony at the inquest. It was also reported that Wormald's numerous inquiries created quote-unquote diplomatic heat between the United States and New Zealand. At one point, the U.S. State Department reportedly contacted New Zealand's Ministry of Foreign Affairs to question why Wormald had so much perseverance on this case. When asked for an opinion about Rodney's death, Wormald stated, quote, "In my view, it is most likely Marks ingested the methanol unknowingly," end quote. The investigation did not turn up any evidence that Rodney was suicidal, as he enjoyed his work, had no financial problems, and of course, he had recently fallen in love and gotten engaged to Sonia Walter. Furthermore, the fact that Rodney kept visiting the base's medical facility when he became ill seemed to dismiss the possibility that he had any intention of taking his own life. But on the other hand, since Rodney was a very well-liked person at the base, the investigation also failed to turn up any potential suspects who might have had a motive to intentionally poison him by slipping methanol into one of his drinks. However, given Rodney's reputation as a binge drinker, the possibility was also explored that he could have drank some methanol for recreational use, or even accidentally mixed it up with an alcoholic beverage, as methanol has a similar taste to vodka. Rodney was known for having a messy workspace, as nearly 20 empty bottles of both alcohol and lab agents were found on top of his desk after his death. Another interesting theory was provided by Harry Mahar, who worked as the health and safety officer for the Polar Services and was one of the few NSF employees willing to testify at the inquest. According to Mahar, Rodney had purchased what he described as a quote-unquote unusual-shaped bottle of liquor from New Zealand, which had a picture of a shrimp on the label, as well as writing which may have been Portuguese. Some of the employees who answered the New Zealand police's questionnaires confirmed seeing this bottle of liquor, and it was apparently among the empty bottles found on Rodney's desk following his death. When Men's Journal published an extensive article about this case in 2009, an anonymous co-worker from the base sent them an email proposing a potential theory that Rodney had unknowingly purchased some tainted liquor which caused his death. However, since the bottle was likely thrown out before it could be tested, the theory was nothing more than speculation. Even though the New Zealand police were unable to uncover any conclusive answers about Rodney's death, the Marks family still publicly thanked them for their efforts. They did not believe the police were at fault, and were disappointed that neither the NSF or Raytheon made any attempt to contact them. The family suspected that Rodney's case was just not a top priority for the American authorities since he was an Australian citizen. Rodney's father, Paul Marks, has expressed his skepticism about receiving any closure, stating, quote, "After so long, it's probably impossible to ever know what happened, or if he died by sinister means or accident. That's something we have to live with," end quote. The Edmondson Scott South Pole Station erected a memorial plaque for Rodney, and an 8,500-foot mountain in Antarctica's Worcester Range would be named Mount Marks in his honor. But after 20 years, the actual circumstances of how Rodney Marks died are still unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, this episode is truly a first for The Trail Went Cold, as it's not often you get to literally cover a cold case from one of the coldest places on Earth. When this story started getting media coverage, it was often referred to as possibly being the very first South Pole murder, but technically, it may not be the first recorded murder to ever take place in Antarctica. That particular incident is alleged to have occurred in 1959 at the Vostok Station, a Russian research station located in Princess Elizabeth Land, which is believed to be the coldest place on Earth. The story goes that two Russian scientists got into a heated dispute following a chess match, which led to the loser attacking the winner with an ice axe. Different sources give differing accounts about whether or not the victim survived, so I can't vouch for the truthfulness of this story, but apparently, the incident led to the banning of chess games at Soviet-Russian Antarctic stations. Whatever the case, it might also be premature to refer to Rodney Marks' death as a murder, since it's never been conclusively proven. But theoretically, if you wanted to kill someone and get away with it, Antarctica would be an ideal place to commit the perfect murder. One of my all-time favorite movies is John Carpenter's The Thing, and ever since I first watched it, I've always been fascinated by the idea of living at an isolated research station in Antarctica for an extended period of time, and the terrifying possibility of having no means of escape or rescue if something goes horribly wrong. In fact, it's actually become an annual tradition at the Edmondson Scott South Pole Station that right after the last flight home leaves for the winter season, the crew who have stayed behind will have a marathon screening of the original 1951 version of The Thing, the John Carpenter remake, and the 2011 prequel, because technically, they are now in the same position as the characters in those films, as they will have no way in or out for the next 6 months. I mentioned earlier that during the winter months, the weather is so cold that it is nearly impossible for a plane to land there. Another crazy story actually took place at the Amundsen Scott Station 1 year before Rodney Marks' death. A woman named Dr. Jerry Nielsen was assigned to serve as the base's physician, but during the winter season, she discovered a lump in her breast. Due to the weather, there was no way she could possibly be evacuated for months, so Dr. Nielsen was forced to perform a biopsy on herself and self-treat her own cancer, which involved self-administering chemotherapy. The National Science Foundation even sent a military plane to fly over the base and airdrop some medical supplies for her treatment because they could not safely land and pick her up. But thankfully, once they were able to evacuate Nielsen and transport her back to the United States for proper medical attention, her cancer went into remission. Before I start talking about Rodney Marks, I have one more crime story to share, which was chronicled by the late, great true crime writer Anne Rule in one of the chapters of her 2012 book, Lying in Wait, Anne Rule's Crime Files. It involves a 61-year-old man named Robert Allen Baker, who beat and strangled his wife, Kathy Baker, to death in Greenback, Washington, in June of 2012, and wound up receiving a sentence of 52 years in prison. Well, what's interesting is that Baker worked as a defense contractor at the Raytheon Technologies Corporation, and much like Rodney and Sonia Walter, his relationship with his wife began while they were working together at the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station. At the end of her chapter about this case, Anne Rule actually made reference to Rodney Marks, and while she did not know if Baker knew Rodney or was stationed at the South Pole with him, she hoped investigators would look into a potential connection. Well, upon further research, it turns out that Baker did not start working at Raytheon until 2001, 1 year after Rodney's death, so I think we can safely rule him out. The main reason I made mention of this story is because there was some controversy over the fact that Baker was a convicted sex offender who had previously spent time in prison for molesting an underage relative, so Raytheon never should have hired him in the first place, let alone sent him off to Antarctica to meet his future wife. This is why it could have proved very useful for Raytheon and the National Science Foundation to have turned over all their personnel files to the New Zealand police for investigation, because who knows if Rodney may have spent the winter with someone who was capable of murdering him. Let's face it, if you wanted to commit murder, the South Pole during the winter season would be an ideal place and time to do it, because it could be months before law enforcement showed up to conduct a proper investigation. Now, in Rodney's case, his death was initially attributed to natural causes, but you might be wondering how they would handle things if a violent crime did take place. Well, a situation like this occurred at Antarctica's McMurdo Station in 1996, after an incident where an American cook at the facility attacked an American co-worker with a hammer, though thankfully, the victim survived. The McMurdo Station manager was assigned to be a special deputy U.S. Marshal with training in evidence protection, so he had the power to arrest any Americans who committed crimes there. After the attack, he had the cook confined to a hut until FBI agents were able to arrive at the base and take the cook into custody. The advantageous part of this situation is that it's unlikely the confined perpetrator would ever make an attempt to escape because, well, where would they go? Now, like the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station, McMurdo is located in the Ross Dependency region, which is under New Zealand claim, but this particular crime was a clear-cut case of one American violently attacking another American, so there was no ambiguity about handing jurisdiction over to the American authorities. But Rodney Marks' case is a lot more complicated, because he was an Australian citizen, and no one could even be certain if a crime had taken place at all. While it doesn't sound like there were any potential suspects, I'm sure there would be a ton of legal complications if it turned out an American was responsible for his death. There are a number of interesting parallels between this case and the 2005 death of Geeta Angara, which I covered on the podcast last month. As you might recall, Geeta Angar was killed in the middle of her shift at a secure water treatment plant, and since there were 49 other people working there at that time, at least one of them had to be responsible. Well, coincidentally enough, there were also 49 other people working at the Emmonson Scott station at the time Rodney died, so if it was foul play, there's your entire pool of potential suspects. They never did find out who was responsible for the death of Geeta Angara, so the employees at the plant found it very unsettling that someone they showed up to work with every day had to be the murderer. Well, that type of situation would be even more unsettling at an isolated Antarctic research station when you know there's no means of escape. Theoretically, even if the higher-ups at the station had their suspicions that Rodney's death might have been foul play, I can kind of see why they might be compelled to stay quiet about it and classify his death as natural causes. I mean, if it turned out that someone intentionally poisoned Rodney by slipping methanol into one of his drinks, can you imagine the panic that might have ensued? With no way in or out of the South Pole for months, this would mean that everyone was trapped there with a murderer, and without knowing that person's identity, the paranoia would have been sky high. It's definitely not uncommon for people to go stir-crazy while spending long periods of time at an isolated location, so I'm sure an unsolved homicide would have only exacerbated that. So anyway, let's start talking about Rodney himself. It's interesting how when you look at photos of Rodney online, he's not someone you would visualize being a brilliant scientist, as one particular photo shows him with long, purple dreadlocked hair while dressed in a Sonic Youth t-shirt, and of course, he performed in a heavy metal band at the base in his spare time. But it sounds like he was very good at his job and had been doing excellent work on this project before his untimely death. By all accounts, Rodney was a very social, likable guy, and even though one of his colleagues described him as having a dry sense of humor, which could sometimes rub people the wrong way, he had such an affable personality that it was impossible for anyone to ever stay mad at him. In other words, it doesn't sound like he made any enemies who stood out as having a motive to murder him. The one theory which has pretty much been completely discounted is Rodney's death being a suicide, as he showed no signs of depression, really seemed to be enjoying his work, and had just fallen in love with one of the women he was stationed with, Sonia Walter, so much so that they were actually planning to get married once they returned to the mainland. While the isolation of spending 1 year at a remote Antarctic location can definitely lead to depression and mental health issues for some people, Rodney had already gone through this experience once before, and seemed to enjoy it so much that he signed up to do it again. Of course, as I've reiterated on this podcast many times before, just because a person does not show any outward signs of being depressed or unhappy does not necessarily mean they're not feeling suicidal on the inside, but I think that Rodney's actions prior to his death would rule out that possibility. I mean, for starters, drinking methanol is an unnecessarily protracted way to kill yourself, as it sounds like Rodney went through a lot of agony during the final 24 hours of his life. And not to sound flippant, but if someone stationed at the South Pole really felt an urge to end their life, all they'd have to do is step outside without the proper protective gear on, and everything would be over pretty quickly. I think the fact that Rodney kept visiting the base's medical facility for treatment shows that he had no intention of suicide. Even if he had decided to kill himself, but then changed his mind, I'm sure Rodney would have told the doctor he ingested methanol to increase the chances of saving his life. One alternate theory which was proposed is that Rodney could have drank some methanol in order to get a major buzz or something, but once again, I'm sure he would have said something once his illness got really bad. So I have to agree with the New Zealand police's assessment that no matter what happened, it seems very likely that Rodney ingested the methanol unknowingly. Now, it's certainly possible there was no foul play here, and that Rodney did consume some methanol accidentally. Rodney was described as loving his alcohol, but you could probably say that about most of the personnel at the station, since it sounds like drinking was an essential aspect of getting through those long South Pole winters. In fact, while writing about her experience there on a blog, Sonia Walter once said, quote, "I'm not aware of any AA meetings taking place, although it wouldn't be a bad idea for quite a few people here," end quote. Rodney was also described as being a binge drinker at times, though most people would have stopped short of calling him an alcoholic. He had no less than 18 bottles of liquor inside his room at the time of his death, and there were also around 20 empty bottles for both alcohol and lab agents found on his desk. So could it be possible that Rodney mistook a bottle of methanol for liquor and drank it? I mean, Rodney was described as a very cautious person who wouldn't have made a mistake like that, but, well, when you're drunk, your personal judgment can be heavily affected. However, since it was months before anyone could arrive at the station to pick up Rodney's body, all of those bottles, as well as a number of other pieces of potential evidence, were tossed out before anyone even considered the possibility of a homicide investigation. And of course, due to jurisdictional issues, the New Zealand police only got to question a handful of people who were stationed at the base, and most of these interactions were done via questionnaires, which were pre-screened by the National Science Foundation. Even if Roddy was not the victim of an intentional homicide, it's possible his death was the result of negligence on someone's part, which is why the NSF and their employees have been very uncooperative about the whole thing. I mean, the agency claimed they conducted their own internal investigation, but they've never turned their findings over to the New Zealand police, or even provided any evidence to prove this investigation actually took place. And since the New Zealand police's coronial inquest was described as, quote-unquote, informal, the U.S. Department of Justice flat-out told them they had no authority to force the NSF to do anything. This sounds like a major catch-22, because in order for this to happen, the New Zealand police would have had to uncover conclusive evidence that the NSF or Raytheon were complicit in a crime, but there's very little chance of obtaining this evidence without their cooperation. One of the most controversial figures in this whole ordeal is the base physician, Dr. Robert Thompson, who has been the subject of heavy criticism for how he handled the situation once Rodney became seriously ill. In particular, he has been criticized for his failure to maintain and use the base's Ectochem machine, which could have potentially detected the methanol in Rodney's bloodstream before it was too late. It sounds like the fate of Dr. Thompson has sort of become a mystery within a mystery, because after numerous failed attempts by the New Zealand police to track him down and get him to testify at the inquest, his current whereabouts were described as unknown. Of course, I would be interested to know if Thompson genuinely believed that Rodney's death was natural causes, or if he decided to keep any personal suspicions to himself in order to avoid a potential panic at the base. I highly doubt that Thompson was directly involved in some sort of murder conspiracy, but I can see why he would be inclined to avoid answering questions about how he handled the situation in case of potential liability issues. Thompson did originally provide a report about how the situation with Rodney played out, but it would have been very useful to get his clarification on certain things. One particular oddity which has stood out in this case are the two needle marks found on Rodney's right arm. Since Rodney was given separate injections of Haldol and another sedative prior to his death, you might assume this was the source of the needle marks, but Thompson apparently said they were already there before he made the injections. Rodney allegedly admitted to intravenous drug use in the past, but since he was right-handed, it is strange that the marks would be on his right arm. Whatever the case, there were no illegal drugs found in Rodney's system during the autopsy, and while a theory has been proposed that perhaps he attempted to take alcohol intravenously, it sounds like the coroner was pretty certain the methanol was ingested, not injected. It's possible these needle marks have no significance to the case at all, but again, it would have been useful to have Thompson provide some testimony in order to clarify some of these points. While NSF has said they had a zero-tolerance policy for drug use, there have been multiple reports of marijuana being used and grown at the station, which shouldn't be too surprising, but as far as I know, there have never been any confirmed reports about the usage of heroin or any harder drugs which would have required a needle. Now, even though there was a large supply of alcohol available at the base, it apparently wasn't uncommon for people stationed there to operate their own stills to make moonshine. After all, if you're living in complete isolation in the middle of nowhere for an entire year, even drinking traditional alcohol can become monotonous. Apparently, one particularly popular brand of homemade alcohol, which was often brewed at the base, was called Toast Juice, and it's been reported that the New Zealand police were able to obtain a bottle of Toast Juice for ESR testing and discovered that it was 71% pure alcohol. The Toast Juice was also reportedly discounted as being the source of the methanol in Rodney's body, but if people at the base were frequently brewing their own alcohol, you can see how something might have gone horribly wrong. Even if the Toast Juice did not contain methanol, Rodney still could have consumed some homemade moonshine containing methanol without even realizing it. But then again, if Rodney did something like that, and had any inkling that it could have been the source of the illness he was experiencing, wouldn't he have said something to Dr. Thompson? I mean, he may have ultimately gotten into trouble for consuming or making moonshine, but his life was on the line here. This is why I'm intrigued by the theory involving the mysterious bottle of liquor he brought to the base with him, containing a label which appeared to feature Portuguese writing. The bottle was never found, but there were multiple witnesses who recalled seeing it, and if it was thrown away, then this implies the liquor was consumed before Rodney's death. If it happened to be tainted liquor containing methanol, then Rodney may have not had any inkling it was causing his illness, since he obtained it before he even arrived at the South Pole. According to the World Health Organization, tainted alcohol can lead to as many as 300 deaths per year from acute methanol poisoning. In fact, the Men's Journal article about the case I previously mentioned made reference to an incident where a Sherpa wound up dying at a base camp at Mount Everest after drinking methanol-tainted whiskey. If that's what happened, then technically no one from the base had any complicity in Rodney's death, but without having the bottle to test as evidence, it would be impossible to know for sure. But of course, that theory is pure speculation, and I cannot rule out the possibility that something else led to Rodney's poisoning, and that at the very least, someone from that base knows the truth and has never talked. One theory which has been pushed forward is that Rodney's death was the result of a prank gone horribly wrong. I mean, lacing someone's drink with methanol seems like a pretty stupid idea for a practical joke, but people don't always make the best decisions when they're drunk and have been living in isolation for months. That's why it's such a shame that Rodney did not receive a proper autopsy to find the methanol in his system until over 6 months after his death, because by that point, the 49 other people who had been stationed at the base had all gone their separate ways and were scattered all over the world. The key to figuring out what happened to Rodney would be to pinpoint the last time he took a drink. When Rodney was being examined by Dr. Thompson, he said he hadn't taken a drink in nearly 2 days, but where did this drink take place? Was it in the privacy of his own room? Or was it at a social event with numerous people? Did someone else have the opportunity to handle one of Rodney's drinks before they gave it to him? If this had occurred anywhere else besides the South Pole, law enforcement probably would have gotten involved immediately and backtracked Rodney's movements to possibly determine where and when he took the fatal drink containing the methanol. But after more than 6 months, figuring out something like this would be pretty much impossible, particularly since only a small fraction of the base's personnel were willing to answer questions from the New Zealand police. If someone wanted to murder Rodney, poisoning one of his drinks would be the absolute perfect way to do so, because methanol is odorless and known for having a taste that resembles vodka, so Rodney would have never even noticed. But I guess the issue is that Rodney had 150 milliliters of methanol in his system, which is about enough to fill a wine glass, so I have to wonder what he could have been drinking to be able to consume that much without realizing it. Now, I mentioned earlier that no less than 18 liquor bottles were found inside Rodney's room, so theoretically, if someone wanted to sneak into his room and slip methanol into his liquor to poison him, how would they know which bottle to choose? In order for a murder plot to work, the perpetrator would need to be certain that that Rodney was drinking a specific beverage at a specific time, which is why it would have been so useful to piece together Rodney's drinking habits in the days preceding his death. But of course, that still doesn't answer the question about who would have had a potential motive to harm Rodney. Well, you might have noticed that I haven't made much mention of his fiancée, Sonia Walter. Sonia refused to give interviews following Rodney's death, but she did provide evidence at the coronial inquest and would continue to return to Antarctica to work lengthy stints there. It seems like she was content to put the whole incident behind her and move on with her life, and for all we know, she might genuinely believe there was no foul play involved. I certainly don't have any reason to suspect Sonia of anything, but I can't help but wonder if the relationship might have set someone else off. Even though an isolated research station in the South Pole sounds like an unusual place to find your soulmate, by all accounts, Rodney and Sonia fell head over heels in love with each other and seemed to be the perfect match. I mean, the couple had literally not spent any time together in normal civilization before they decided they wanted to get married. But what if there was someone else at the base who had feelings for Sonia and became jealous? I mean, this is not an environment where you can just move on if you see someone you like with another person. If anyone had any issues with seeing Rodney and Sonia together, it's not like they could just avoid the situation, as they were pretty much trapped there for another 6 months. I have to wonder if this could have driven someone to murder, but once again, this is all just pure speculation, since I have not heard any stories about anyone having issues with Rodney and Sonia's relationship, or any friction ever developing over it at the base. I mean, I certainly hope that Rodney's death wasn't a murder, because if it was, the responsible party has done a very successful job of getting away with it. If the New Zealand police somehow uncovered evidence which pointed to a specific suspect, I can only imagine the red tape which might be involved in order to make an arrest and bring them to trial. While I discount the suicide theory, and am pretty certain that Rodney was completely unaware that he consumed methanol, I really don't think there's enough conclusive evidence to point towards his death being a homicide or some sort of freak accident, such as drinking tainted moonshine. But if it's the latter, then I do have to wonder if there are some people from the base who have always known more than they let on. I know that Detective Senior Sergeant Wormald speculated that there might have been some employees from the NSF and Raytheon who did not want to cooperate because they feared it might affect their employment prospects. It's quite sad that Rodney's family have stated that they've pretty much come to terms with the fact that they might not receive any answers about what happened to him, and given the jurisdictional issues, there's not really anything they can do about it. Given the amount of time that has passed, if someone knows something, I really wish they would come forward to at least put the Marks family at peace and assure them that there isn't somebody out there getting away with murder. However, if the situation is something like Rodney being poisoned by a tainted bottle of liquor that he purchased elsewhere before he arrived at the base, then we will probably never know the truth. All that being said, if you happen to have any information about the unexplained death of Rodney Marks, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about an unsolved mystery from the life of the most famous mystery writer of all time, Agatha Christie, who went missing in 1926 before she resurfaced 11 days later, and there are still a lot of unanswered questions about the circumstances of how and why she disappeared. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Gentry, Matt K, and Jennifer Q. Thank you all so much for your support. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.